Is it 2022 yet?
It's only 2022?
No, is it 2022? I don't know. I'm trying to think about when this is going to actually post. This, our patrons are going to get this in 2021, but our wider listenership will receive it in the first week of 2022. So happy 2022, everyone.
Shouldn't we say that at the end of 2022?
I don't know.
It was happy 2022 instead of saying, hey, I guess that's just optimism and I'm just a grumpy bastard.
This, without optimism, what do we have anymore?
You have me is what you have. Great. Lordy. This is not helping our listenership at all.
No, it's not.
Right.
It's absolutely not. My team, finally, after we've won trivia before. It's been a long time.
Oh, trivia team.
Trivia. I got okay. Trivia story. Okay. We went to trivia this week. And so it's a Sunday morning. We were going to record last night on a Saturday night, which means imbibing a little while we record. And then my schedule got all messed up. And one of the things I was going to have you do, because I thought it would be fun, I came home. I won 2 32-ounce growlers at trivia this past week. And I was going to have you pick which one I should have.
Ah.
And, of course, then we didn't record. And I almost texted you anyway to say I was kind of invested in letting you pick my beverage this evening, but I went ahead and picked it myself.
Mm, nice.
So we should have won.
I would say pick the slushy Trappist Double.
Yeah, that was not one of the options.
Oh, okay.
I had a chocolate pretzel stout, and I had a fruited Kolsch. I went with the stout last night, as which is really no surprise to anyone who knows me. So we were playing trivia. We were tied at the end with another team, and we had to do a rock, paper, scissors off to see who got first place. And I was our representative, and I went paper, and I lost.
You flubbed it.
I flubbed it. But here's the thing. Here's the old man thing. We should not have been put in that position. One of the questions, and God knows. So the categories were such illustrious things this past week as Seth Rogen was a category.
Oh, God.
Bikinis was a category.
Okay, I could do okay on that one.
You know what? I don't think you could. It was a lot of, you know, the mechanics of the fashion. And luckily, we had a woman in our group who knew some of these things. Tankinis and string bikinis and all these things that, like, I would have known.
I'm a connoisseur of the bikini. Anyway.
Yeah, well. They had a question.
Friend next time.
There was one question that was asked 2 weeks in a row, and we got it right this time because we got it wrong last time. I don't remember the whole question. It was some stupid Seth Rogen movie from 10 years ago, and which actress was in a whipped cream bikini?
Mm-hmm.
And it was Ali Larder.
Ali Larder.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Don't remember what the movie was, but we got it wrong 2 weeks ago, and then it came up again. We're like, oh my God, it's Ali Larder. So the reason that we tied and weren't winning during one of the potluck categories, why this is a question, I don't know, but it was if you have very loose, uncontrollable stools, you have this.
I knew it. I knew it was going to be about your old man bowels.
Yeah. So how would you answer that question?
I mean, I hear I was going to say something about Metamucil. Like, it comes in perfect dovetails so nicely.
Yep.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
if you have loose stools, what is that called? What is that condition called?
Loose stools?
Yes.
Well, it depends on how loose you are on the Bristol.
I think watery was used in the description as well. I'm trying not to make this just completely repulsive.
Is this a slang term or is this a...
Well, that was not made clear.
Ah, see, they need to clarify these things.
So we wrote down IBS.
Diarrhea.
The answer was diarrhea. And she says, and I'll accept the shits. But when I went up there and it said no, I said, are you seriously not giving us credit for IBS? Well, we really weren't looking for that. I said, you're accepting the shits and not irritable bowel syndrome? So we did not get credit for that. And as a result, we were tied at the end of the night. Okay, so to the folks at Best Trivia Ever, which I am now going to refer to as the okayest trivia sometimes.
Yeah.
Bullshit. I call absolute bullshit on that.
Yeah.
Now, when we explained to the owner of our establishment who is our age that happened, he said, oh, well, in second place, you're supposed to get 2 32-ounce growlers. I'm giving you guys the first place prize. You're getting 2 64-ounce growlers. So we said, thank you, Mark. That's nice. That's, you know, those old folks have to stick nice. Together.
Yeah.
So that was my experience at trivia this week.
Well, see, young people don't understand what IBS is. Mm-hmm. They don't spend enough time watching public access TV and reruns of Matlock. So to know about Geritol, you need to focus more on K-pop and watch like Nick videos and stuff like that to get really up on what's happening. Well, my wife loves to watch the music videos on the weekends, and that's how she stays relevant. And some kind of splashes on me on the side, so I know about the whole K-pop boy band robot thing. Yeah.
Yeah, no. I hear some of it from my kids. And I will say the very first question of the night, I got it right for our team, and it was a My Little Pony question. And they will not let me live it down.
Well, that's just because you're such an avid collector.
No. I got the answer immediately. They would not. 3 rounds later, something.
Oh, you're Strawberry Shortcake. That's right.
Yes, yes. Thank you. I'm much more Strawberry Shortcake. Yeah, and a little bit of Ultron, but more Strawberry Shortcake.
Okay.
The 3 rounds later, there's a question about voyeurism. And one of the people I'm there with is talking about there's cuckolding, there's voyeurism, there's all these different versions of it. And I look at the two, and they're debating it, the two of them. And I look at them, I go, okay, I think I'm officially off the hook from the My Little Pony stuff earlier. They're like, no, you're not. I said, how is this not worse?
I thought you were going to talk about voyeurism and My Little Pony, in which case I was like, we're stopping right there.
In fairness, the My Little Pony question was, what are adult fans of My Little Pony called? but you're refusing to answer so that I look foolish. I know how this game works. I know how this game works. I'm going to leave this to Alistair to post on the Discord.
Yep. Go ahead.
Adult fans of My Little Pony. And yes, I knew the answer. I knew the answer in all candor from a Patton Oswalt comedy routine on Netflix.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Sure. We're going to go with that.
That's what we're going to go with.
That's where you know it from. Mm-hmm. Can we get on with the getting on here?
I guess we can. I'm sure there. So we're usually, it takes us about 6 minutes to get through the bullshit usually. Where are we? Ooh, 8.5. 8.5. Okay.
Running along.
Yep. Going a little long. I think there might be some hops we can talk about here.
Yeah, you think so.
Yeah. So science. We're going to do some science. We haven't done some science in a while.
Right.
Well, hold on. We both just saw Spider-Man. Do we need to talk about that too for a while?
No, we don't. We did. We talked about that for an hour before we started.
Wow, we did. We've been on for a while already. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll save that for the other podcast. Very good.
Yep. I need to see some more trailers to know what the next MCU steps are so we can start building our intricate multiverse plans here. But we're going to talk about hops today. Hello. And we're going to talk about sciencey science. We might talk about it. I might throw some enzymes at you.
Oh, my little red misspelling line is already ready to go here.
Yep. One of the things that, okay, no joke, I struggled this week to come up with a topic, mm-hmm. a sciencey science topic, because frankly, at least from my perspective, we've talked about a lot of sciencey science in production of hops over our back catalog, and we still keep getting similar questions over things we've already covered. So if you're not a patron, pony up and go back and listen to the back catalog, because stuff's there. But I realize there's so much stuff there, it can be difficult to find it.
Yep. We're going to add a new Patreon tier. We'll call it like a platinum tier. Yeah. And for, I don't know, $200 a month, we'll do a podcast, you know, specifically geared toward individuals.
Just for you.
Yeah. Give us your question. We'll give you 45 minutes on that topic. It's only a slight increase over the existing, you know, Patreon dues. $200 a month. You can have your own monthly podcast.
I'm all in. Let's do it. My wife was asking me, she's helping me come up with topics. And she gave me a few good ones, which I'm going to research for later since it takes some work. But she's like, well, what's new in hop research?
And it's like, if our conversation had a soundtrack, there would have been crickets in there. Because, frankly, nothing. At least nothing that's relevant to anybody who listens to this podcast. If you're, you know, a 500 or 1,000 acre hop farmer and you have proprietary varieties, there's some interesting new research coming out about certain management practices for Citra or Mosaic or, you know, what have you. But not for Galena. Sorry, pal. So nor is it for someone, let's say, oh, in South Africa or, I don't know, the Yucatan. So for us, there's really not a lot of research out there. So it's like, where do you go? What do you, how do you keep this current with the science in hop production? So I started thinking about what are the current trends that I'm reading about just in general in agriculture. And we've talked a little bit about this, about how we wanted to start bringing in things like agricultural robots just because we think they're cool. And, you know, future farming, because it is impactful for anyone who has anything to do with the beer industry. But specific for hops, what is a growing concern that is only going to get worse? We see it on the horizon for most of us, not all of us, this is going to get worse. And it is water availability, like not having enough of it. Mm-hmm. And we saw, for instance, Justin, one of our hopnologists up in southern Canada, had record heat this past summer and drought in places that you would never expect it. And this is getting more and more common. And we've been talking about the droughts in Europe and Germany specifically for the last decade. And in more recent years, the fires and droughts in the Pacific Northwest and the impact that's, that potential has on yield, right?
Sure.
Okay. If you don't have a good water source, I mean, think about how much we rely on precipitation for irrigation. It's like if you get a half to three quarters up to an inch of rain a week, you don't have to irrigate. That's plenty of water as long as your soil water levels are reasonably charged up. That's disappearing. So it's like, yeah, I haven't had really more than a quarter of an inch of rain in 2 weeks. Uh-oh. Right now I'm irrigating every day. And then that quarter of an inch of rain in 2 weeks turns into, I haven't had a drop of rain in a month. And frankly, there's really no economical, feasible way to dump enough water on your hop plants to keep them as happy as they want to be for as much water as they want when you're in a drought scenario. You're just not, you can't do it. You're going to irrigate 24 hours a day, yep, and you're still not going to have enough water for multiple reasons. What we see then is we see when water resources are restricted, we see plant nutrient deficiencies. And they could actually show up as deficiencies. They're going to show up as low yield. They're going to show up as all kinds of things. And the question is why? Like, why does that happen? And what can we do about it? Like, how can we mitigate the effects of drought and less than ideal water, available water, in our crop, because it is a real thing? And what is the reality of that? What does that ultimately mean for us in our hop yard? Can I figure out a way, if I've got irrigation, does it matter if I have a drought? Everything's going to be fine? No. That's not what it means. It depends on where that drought's coming from. But that's the whole idea today, is to take a look at nutrients, their relative availability in the soil, and how plant available water levels affect their uptake. Because there's a couple of things that usually goes on. So when you think drought, you don't think drought like it's dry and a very comfortable 76 degrees Fahrenheit. you think drought and holy hell,
yeah,
things are melting, right? Mm-hmm. So those usually go hand in hand. And so you've got a double whammy here. You've got the fact that you've got a lack of water and it's so hot that the plant is also undergoing heat stress. So you've got drought stress and heat stress hitting you. And then you're going to come and ask me questions like, well, why is my yield so poor? Well, why do you think? Well, I know I was under drought and I could have irrigated more. And man, it was really hot. So the plants are probably stressed. But why is my yield so bad? Okay, so that's what we need to link together. Is these environmental factors, particularly drought stress, and why is your yield suffering? And how can you mitigate that effect?
Well, water, right?
Ideally, well, primarily water is one thing. when you're talking about drought stress. That's usually what you're focused on, drought stress, lack of water. We've, how many times have we talked about this? Nutrients go through the roots, through the soil, into the roots, into the plant, and to where they need to go in the plant. If you don't have enough soil water to move those nutrients around, the plant's not going to be able to take them up. Straight up, right?
Right.
So you think, well, but I'm irrigating, right? I see my drippers are going, and the ground is moist. It is. So now ask yourself the next question. If the ground is moist, and you can dig down, you know, deeper than about 8 inches, what's it like down there? Is it dry and crumbly, or is it nice and moist? Because you really do need more than just slightly damp in order to get these nutrients to move around.
Especially in that kind of a heat environment where, you know, the ground may be moist, but to your point, maybe it's just the surface that's moist.
And if there's no, let's say, cover over that, and it's just open to the sun, evaporation is going to take that stuff out of the top of the soil faster than it can percolate down into the root zone. So you've got that going on for you too. So really it's more about, okay, I know I'm irrigating, but James, I can't irrigate anymore. It's about how are you irrigating and when you're doing it. So you're saying it's super dry and it's warmer than average. And I turn my irrigation on at 8 a.m. and it's running all day until, you know, 9, 10 o'clock at night. Well, why are you irrigating during the day if you're trying to get water down in the subsoil and it's hot and sunny and it's boiling, evaporating the water off the surface faster than it can get into the subsoil? Well, do it when it's not threatening so much evaporation from the soil surface. Do it at night. Get it deep into the root zone, because this is also what's going to happen. Let's couple this with heat. So when these plants both are under low water stress and they're under high heat stress, the first thing they're going to do is close their stomata, right? Those little openings on their leaves. Because they're going to say, I need to conserve water. So they're actually going to close their stomata. And when that happens, there is no potential. There's, we call it a potential, right? Where you're moving from an area of high concentration to low concentration. That's how you drive this water uptake. So when you close the mouth, the little stomata on the leaf, there's no more water leaving the plant, so there's no more real impetus for water to go into the plant. So your plant stops taking up water, at least, you know, from an active water uptake. You know, there's passive water uptake, just sort of leaches into the plant. But, well, if it's not actively taking up water, it's not actively taking up nutrients.
Sure, sure, and you can water all you want, but it's... To your point, other than the passive approach, you're not getting any benefit out of that.
So as the leaf temperature and the plant temperature climbs and climbs and climbs to the point where the plant actually closes its stomata, you could be irrigating just fine and have plenty of subsurface, subsoil water. But the plant's not taking it up because it's shut down due to heat. And now you're going to get yourself into a heat-related nutrient deficiency. Because the plant's like, yeah, I know there's food in the ground, but I'm just not hungry. I'm not eating right now. And it's only going to take up enough water to keep it, frankly, alive. Think about it like that. So you've got a double whammy here. Even if you are irrigating, let's say, in cooler hours, and maybe you're going to do split irrigation, you're going to irrigate, you know, at dawn for a few hours, you know, half the day, and during the heat of the day you're not irrigating, and then you're going to irrigate in the evening when the temperature's down, the sun's going down. And then not all night, that's fine. But if those temperatures are spiking into the, you know, 90s Fahrenheit, and that leaf temperature is up in the 100 and 120 degree Fahrenheit range, those plants are shutting down anyway. They're closing their stomata, at least for most of these varieties. So you're going to find nutrients stress, lack of nutrients. I'm not going to say deficiencies, because you may not see them yet as deficiencies. Visual deficiency symptoms, but they're going to be there. So keep those two factors in mind. There's more than one thing at play here. When people's like, oh yeah, you know, I know my potassium's low because I had drought stress. Well, was it? Was it drought stress? Were you irrigating enough such that you were compensating for the lack of water? And if that's the case, it's not due to drought stress. It's due to something else. What is it? What were your temperatures? Holy hell, you were, you know, your average daily high was 97 degrees when it's not supposed to be. Yeah, wasn't drought stress. It was heat stress that was doing that. You weren't taking up enough nutrition. So if the plant's not taking that up, and you know that's what your current conditions, you know, and future forecasts looks like, hot and dry, and maybe not even dry, maybe just super duper hot, adding more nutrient to the soil isn't going to help you.
Sure.
You got to get into the plant some other way. And how do you do that? You do it through foliar applications. Mm-hmm. How many of us as growers have a foliar nutrition plan? Now, you may have one that is focused on like secondaries and micros. That's great, because usually soil chemistry is the limiting factor there in those micronutrient uptake parameters, not drought or temperature issues. You're not going to be able to give that plant everything that it needs from a nutrient standpoint through its leaves. You just can't. You will burn the living shit out of that plant, and it'll defoliate, and then you won't have to worry about drought. You know, it's okay.
Right. Other problems.
It's not using any water at all now. Look at that. I solved it. It's 100% efficient.
Now, when you talk about I'm sure we're going to get into the details of this, but we're talking about extreme heat situations. Mm-hmm. So is foliar application a backup plan, or is it a necessary supplement regardless of what's going on with Mother Nature?
In the terms of environmental stress, heat, drought stress, this discussion is all predicated on the idea of how do I mitigate yield losses due to environmental impacts. Mm-hmm. And in this case, due to drought and heat stress, my yield is going to be subpar because the plant's not actively taking in nutrients through its root system. So how can I get some nutrients into this plant to make my yield loss not as bad as it would be? You're not going to make up your total yield production through foliar applications. You're just not. So this is more about a doing the best with what I've got sort of scenario. If you have a soil chemistry that doesn't allow for appropriate like nutrient availability due to pH or, you know, some other, you know, soil structure or what have you, then you can be looking at adding some supplements foliar as part of your normal day-to-day activities, but it's not going to be enough to sustain your plant. That's not how plants evolved. Right. Plants evolved to take up nutrients through their roots, especially hops that love damp, damp, damp soil. That's part of their genetics. So all of our nutrient uptake, or our primary nutrient uptake pathway, has to be through the root system. So that's what we have to be thinking about. In the scenarios that I'm talking about, it's all about what can you do when that is not an option. Foliar feeding is the way to go. There are boundaries of which, you know, some nutrients are not, cannot transfer across the cuticle. So you're not going to be like pounding phosphorus through the into the plant by foliar application. It's just not going to work. So only some nutrients are foliar transmittable. So you're going to need to look into that. It's going to be things like potassium and calcium and magnesium and manganese and boron and things like that. Nitrogen, some nitrogen in nitrate form will penetrate the cuticle. These things are all salts. And what happens when, like, you know, you get your hands in like salt water for a long time, they get all pruny and wrinkly and they dry out. Same thing's going to happen to the plant. So you can't be pounding these things with salty water, especially when it's hot, because that droplet's going to evaporate quick before those salts can penetrate the leaf, and you're going to be left with salt crystals on the surface. That's going to dry out the cuticle. It's going to actually suck water out of the plant, and that's how you get foliar burning. So this is not just I've got drought and heat problems, I'm just going to hose on a bunch of fertilizer. No, don't do that. This is a way to try to reduce your losses by being very careful about spoon feeding through the cuticle, not about dumping fertilizer on the cuticle thinking that you don't ever need to spread it on the soil again.
Right.
Different animal. Let's make this even more complicated, okay?
Sure.
This was all very boring and easy. The other thing that I see is growers that are, let's call them new growers. So people that are not legacy or generational growers. They have no concept, nor have they practiced root pruning at all. And per the single episode that we did that dove deeply into the root zone and all the root anatomy, as you will recall, as everyone scrambles to find that episode, nutrient uptake is taken solely through the root hairs. They're not taken up through branches. They're not taken up through main trunks of roots. They're taken up through root hairs. And frankly, most of the root hairs you can't even see. They are microscopic and barely macroscopic. So you can just barely see them. Even the ones that you pull up, you're like, oh, look at all those root hairs. Those are great. No, those aren't root hairs. those are root laterals still. Root hairs grow and die every year through the cycle, which is one of the reasons why there's debate on hydroponic hops and their longevity, because when they're in perpetual production, those root hairs don't die to regenerate. So that's an interesting physiological thing going on there. In the field, though, under normal, let's say, quote, normal hop physiology and environmental aspects like dormancy, those hops are, when they go dormant, those root hairs will die. And the next year, as the root continues to grow, the root tips continue to expand and elongate, root hairs will pop out behind those elongating points. And those will be ready for uptake for the following, you know, for that year. That's one of the reasons why early applications of fertilizer on hops don't necessarily do a whole lot of good. Like in the season, like you're like, hey, it's emergence. I'm going to go and hit it with all this fertilizer. And you're like, well, I did that and nothing happened. Well, it's because the plant was probably still growing root hairs. And that happens very quickly once the plant starts to wake up. You know, the roots will be the first thing to grow and they'll elongate and they'll sprout these root hairs. Here's the rub, is that as these roots structure get bigger and bigger and bigger and thicker, they become more and more woody. And you may have heard me talk about woodlock and why old hop plants that are not root pruned end up requiring so much energy just to support their root biomass that their shoot biomass, the stuff that grows above the ground, tends to get weaker and weaker and less vigorous.
Yep.
So what do we do? How do we fix that? Well, we have to reduce the root mass. And we do that through pruning. And root pruning is nothing more than going down either side of, let's say, your bed. Let's say your bed is a meter wide, and you're going to go down either perimeter, the edge of the bed and the interrow, and you're going to slice down through there with either a disc on a plow or a shank on a ripper or something like that. Down, I've seen them go as shallow as about 6 inches and as deep as about 18 inches. And you're going to physically sever the roots that have grown out into the interrow. And you're like, what? Why the hell would I do that? Because what's happened is the root biomass has become so woody and so unbranched that really the only growing points, there's too few growing points on the roots compared to the rest of the biomass of the root system. So we need to force those roots to branch and branch aggressively and create more root hairs. How do we do that? We go and we prune the roots. Because every place that we cut those roots, they're going to scab over and they're going to create a bunch of cells. It's called callus cells that are going to turn into new root sprouts that are going to form new rootlets. They're going to turn into like this broom, right? Instead of having a long straw, you're going to have cut it and it's going to be all these other buds that sprout out from it. So you're going to end up with this bushy thing. And you want this root system to be all bushy and fuzzy, right? You don't want long, ropey roots. So one of the problems I see is that young growers are not root pruning on the appropriate schedule or at all. And their root hair to root overall root mass ratio is way out of whack. To the point where it's like, I'm applying my fertilizer on the row, but I'm not seeing the yield. Everybody talks about, well, apply, you know, or my data even say, let's assume you're doing proper agronomy here and you've got actual data on your how much potassium you need, and you spread it on your row, right? Your meter wide band. And you're still like, why am I still freaking potassium deficient? It's showing I put plenty down. I've got plenty of water going into the soil, and the temperature's not too high. What's wrong? Mm-hmm. Well, what's wrong is you don't have any freaking root hairs where you put your fertilizer, or you have very sure. few, because all your root hairs are at the end of the roots, which are now out in your interrow. Put the fertilizer where it needs to go. Soil water does not like to move laterally. So you're thinking, well, I put it here, I'll just irrigate and it'll spread out. No, it won't. It goes in a cone straight down. Depending on your soil type, that cone width and depth changes a little bit, the geometry changes, but it doesn't like to move laterally. It likes to move vertically. So if your root hairs are 10 feet, 5 feet away from where you're putting your fertilizer, you're likely not even fertilizing them.
Wow.
So people say, well, then I should fertilize out here in my interrow then. You could, but now think about this. What is the root hair density in that column of soil? Very low.
Sure. Sure, it's where all your extraneous stuff is going on.
Exactly. So you're going to be spreading all of your fertilizer out there now, with the likelihood of that fertilizer actually finding the roots before it leaches being much lower than if you root pruned, densified those root hairs into a smaller soil volume, and applied your fertilizer there. So you're maximizing the plant's likelihood that it's actually going to be able to grab those nutrients mm-hmm. and take them up.
But, you know, I mean, think about the cost of – everything has a cost. So all that extra fertilizer to put on the interrow and for a less efficient pickup, mm-hmm. just prune.
Exactly. It's going to help your plant. It's also going to invigorate the top growth, because we need a ratio between the roots and the shoots in order to maintain the appropriate physiological balance. There's an actual number to that, but nobody's going to dig up their entire root mass to figure out what that is.
Right.
Trust me, we do this in apples. We do it in all of our tree fruits are root pruned. Grapes are root pruned. We do this because there's a reason. It's all about root hair formation.
Now, I know you said a few minutes ago, you know, on the appropriate schedule, and I'm sure everyone has their calendar open and they're waiting for you to tell them the appropriate schedule.
Well, obviously, if you've got a new plant, you got to wait for it to get mature. Mm-hmm. So you're really not, I would suggest, not even think about doing any root pruning until the plant is over 3 years old.
Mature to the point like it knows what IBS is, that kind of mature.
Correct. Yes, okay. Exactly. Good. It's starting to think that Metamucil is a good idea.
Yep.
So at that point, you're going to want to do what in the industry is called blocking up. And this idea of root pruning, which is taking those roots and pruning them so they stay in a block within or near the actual growing row, not out into the interrow and doing whatever it is that it wants to do underground. So this is not rhizome digging. This is root pruning. Most of those feeder roots are very shallow. Like I said, they're in the top. I think 18 inches is pretty deep, frankly. They're going to probably be in the top 12 inches, most of them. And even if you look in the row, and you dig down just a couple of inches, you're going to just find ropey, these big, fat, ropey roots all over the place. And you're like, oh, those are rhizomes. No, probably not. Those are roots. So they're not too deep. By doing that, by doing the pruning, you can force those plants to send out more root laterals, which creates more root hairs for the given volume of soil and the given volume of root mass that it's got, so that it's maximizing its opportunity to take up nutrients and water. That's another reason that people need to think about that. I'm dumping all this water on my plants and I still see nutrient problems, or I still see, you know, the plants struggling due to drought stress. Well, it's probably because your root mass is so diffused that you would have to have a rain over a wide area in order to get enough moisture into the soil where the roots are actively taking it up, compared to where you're just dripping it on the soil. So block your roots up, get them to where the nutrients and the water are, especially when you're in a drought scenario. You're going to find a dramatic improvement in your nutrient uptake and your yield, even given the fact that you're in a drought scenario. That's it. Those are the three things, right? Root pruning, understanding when you're putting your water on to maximize its penetration, and understanding the fact that when you have a high temperature, that it doesn't matter whether you've root pruned and you're putting on, quote, enough water. If the plant is not actively taking up water because it's the stomata are closed, you have to figure out another way to get nutrients into the plant.
Sure.
It's not, again, like we say with most sciencey science topics and hops, it's not just one thing simple. It's usually a whole pile of things that are leading to your issues.
Now, I don't know if we want to get this deep into it, but when it comes to foliar application, what do you need? I mean, this is a whole new set of equipment.
No, you have it. I mean, ideally, you've got some sort of sprayer to spray your hops for things like downy mildew or spider mites or what have you. That's what you're using.
Okay, so it's all you've already got this stuff.
You've already got this stuff. And in many cases, you can make one trip. You can do tank mixing, right? You can have multiple. You got to be very, very careful.
Yep.
Per some of our fungicide episodes about which fungicides and salts you're mixing together. But it's not like another trip. You can mix many of these things together. And in some cases, herbicides and fungicides and things like that that actually have to get into the plant, they want you to add things like urea or nitrates to your solution because that helps to drive penetration. So not at all uncommon. You're not talking about extra special equipment. You're not talking about extra trips through the field necessarily. You're just talking about timing it correctly, figuring out what solutions you can mix together and which ones that you can't. And understanding that you're not going to be able to get every nutrient that your plant's going to need through the cuticle. It's just not going to happen. So don't be surprised if you still show up short on some of your nutrients. Let's say you do a petiole analysis and it's like, well, I'm still short on phosphorus and I'm in one of these drought scenarios. Well, duh, because you can't get it in through the cuticle. Mm-hmm. Well, James, phosphorus is a primary nutrient. And if I don't have enough of it, I'm screwed. Yeah, you are pretty much. Your yield's going to suffer. There's nothing you can do about it. Or is there? There might be. Have you ever heard of a soil wetting agent? Probably not.
Wetting agent.
Yeah, you're probably not into the parlance of agri-science like I am. So
this, I've got wedding planner jokes to make, but go on.
Yeah. So back in the 80s, remember back during Farm Aid? Remember that?
I do.
Yeah. The massive, massive droughts we had, and the farmers were all basically starving to death. Well, there are these chemicals that people were adding to their irrigation water as what they call wetting agents to basically help. It makes water wetter. Have you ever heard that term before? basically, what it does is these agents, these chemicals, break the surface tension of water so that they flow over things a little better. And we use them in our spray solutions all the time. We call them adjuvants. We had an entire episode about it. And Joe was on years ago. We talked about adjuvants and their chemistry. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, let's add these things to soil and we'll make that water that much more available, make it wet and adhere to the soil particles faster, blah, blah, blah. In some cases, that does work, frankly. And some of the stuff they use is a compound called lignosulfate. So it's a product, it's a byproduct from the wood pulping industry. You can find it. It's a soluble powder. You could mix that into your tank if you've got really, let's say, clayey type soil that doesn't like to absorb water very easy because the surface tension of water is too high. You can put some of these products in your water to allow it to wet those particles a little more evenly and quickly so it doesn't leach as fast. Sand doesn't help so much, but in sand, you want to use a different kind of compound like humic acid, which is, again, a liquid, but it's liquid organic matter, and organic matter holds onto water like a sponge. So you can improve your soil's water-holding capacity such that when you're applying your irrigation water, it's just not leaching through, whether it doesn't have anything to hold onto or it's got such a high surface tension that it doesn't even penetrate the soil and just runs off the surface. Hmm. So there are wetting agents out there that are available. Total different topic. I don't want to get too deep into it. What you want to avoid is any of these water-holding gels. Have you ever seen this stuff? It's basically the same stuff they put in diapers, right? It's called polyacrylamide. And it's a polymer. And It's this tiny little white crystal. And when you put it in water, it absorbs like 100 times its weight in water. You're like, oh my God, that's awesome. So I could put this stuff on my soil and water it, and it will just, as it releases water, you know, as you know, it sucks it up and releases like a sponge. Well, sort of, kind of. It only releases about 80% of its water the first time it goes through a shrink swell. And then every time it does that, it releases less and less and less and actually starts sucking water out of the soil. So, yeah, there's a reason we don't see these used in agriculture much anymore, because it doesn't work. So if anybody's trying to sell you on these, you know, polymers that you put in your soil to absorb water and slowly release it, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, that sounds like those weekend fish food things you toss in a tank and, like, you know.
Sort of, yeah. Fish feeders. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are my hop plant feeders for water. Yeah, I don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. It looks kind of neat when it rains or you irrigate. It looks like there's like this clear jelly all over the field. But, oh,
Lord. I think I had a beer with those hops in it recently.
I thought you were going to say you had a beer with polyacrylamide in it, which you might have, actually.
It's possible.
Yeah, it is possible. But just don't do it. There's no shortcutting that. It's as everything in agri-science and plant physiology, it's a very complex, interdependent relationship of all these factors. So when you show me your data on your plant nutrients and you show me your irrigation schedule, I want to see your irrigation schedule. I also want to see your daytime temperatures, and I want to understand your root pruning activities. All of those things together need to be taken to get the big picture of your overall mechanics of why your yield suffered and was it due to X, Y, or Z.
I call absolute bullshit on that.